Technology is necessary, but not enough. I would never downplay its importance, but I would really challenge this idea that it will solve the problems. But I would not end there, because I would argue a lot of social innovation is also not enough.
What does it take to make radical change a reality? Can a new technology be the hero? Or do we need to address social issues? Issues of power and who holds it, before new ways of living and being can take hold. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Today, I'm talking about these issues with Floor Avellino. Floor is an expert with the Dutch Research Institute for Transitions and one of several authors on the Manifesto for Transformative Social Innovation. We talk about Wikipedia, the rise and capture of the sharing economy, and how change can become a reality. Let's dig in. Today, I am joined by Floor Avellino. Floor has a very unique and valuable expertise. She is an expert on how things change. Floor is a researcher with DRIFT, the Dutch Research Institute for Transitions, and also a faculty member in the Department of Public Administration and Sociology at the Erasmus University of Rotterdam. Now, I collaborated with Floor on a small project years ago, but it's been ages since I've spoken with her. Floor, it is great to have you here.
Thank you very much also for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here. I remember when we first met in Canada, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Floor, as you know, the reason that I started this podcast is because people sometimes have a hard time envisioning change. They either don't see that change is happening all around them because perhaps their baselines are shifting, or they just can't imagine the world any other way than what they're currently living in. But change has a habit of sneaking up on you. Everybody is carrying smartphones in their pocket, for example, these days, and on social media. Or I think of the pandemic and how quickly businesses of the world pivoted to remote work after years of pushing back against the prospect of telecommuting. I wonder if you can get this conversation started by talking about how you understand change. Where do we start?
So I think one of the most important things to realize when you think about change is to understand how many different types and levels of change there are. So there is innovation, there is systems change, there is transformation, and these are all interlinked. But a crucial phenomenon is that they don't automatically lead to one another, and sometimes they might even be counterproductive. So it sounds maybe paradoxical to some, but in research this is well studied that, for instance, certain innovations can actually help to keep things the same. So there is this paradox of change that things are changing all the time, and it's through change that they can stabilize certain other aspects of a system, for instance. So I think that's very important to understand, and also to kind of, on the one hand, challenge naive ideas that change will come very fast. But at the same time, I also think this is an important understanding to challenge cynicism. So when people say nothing changes, I always say, well, things change all the time, but it might just take very long, or it's maybe not changing as radically as you like, or maybe not at the level that you would want to. So change is happening all the time, and it's important to understand what kind of change we're talking about and at which level.
So with that as a backdrop, I wonder if we can spend a little bit of time on change and how it works, and why in your work you give so much attention to power. How do you understand power?
So after almost 20 years of thinking and studying about power, that's always the most difficult question to answer. Like, how do you understand power? It's such a big concept that there's like 100 concepts that explode in my mind. But I think maybe one of the things to mention here that is most important in relation to change, and this is also what triggered my fascination for the topic, is when I started interviewing people about why things didn't change the way they wanted to, because they were working on it very hard, or there were lots of innovations. And then I started interviewing people about, you know, what's the challenge? Like, why, what's the impediment? Like, many times people would say, oh, that's because of power. That's because of vested interests. So there is often this dominant and recurring discourse that change is made impossible by power. But then when you start asking people about, okay, so what do you mean by power then? And who has it? Then you discover that it's actually a very elusive concept, and that it's very unclear who has it and what it is and what it isn't. So it's a lot of different things. And it's also debated a lot in theory, whether it's mostly about capacity, and while others see power as the complete opposite, it's about incapacity, and it's about structures and institutions, and it's about everything that impedes us from changing things, while others associate power very much with the capacity to change things. And in the end, it's really both, and it's about the dynamic interaction between those different aspects.
Mm-hmm. As I listen, I'm thinking about my own work on food and food systems, which are a great example, I think, of systems dominated by highly powerful and entrenched regimes that are very hard to change. You mentioned capital, for example. Transnational agribusinesses currently hold so much of the capital in the global food system, whether in terms of seeds and intellectual property, whether access to the best agricultural lands, and so on. So people trying to develop alternatives are challenged to create space for those alternatives, to build and expand their niche. But at the same time, if you look at the last few decades, a lot of change and disruption has in fact taken place, led by alternative, or what I like to call oppositional, food systems movements. Organic is now a household label, and lots of people are getting everything from their local veg to seafood delivered right to their door. What do you think, with that as a concrete example, what does a change maker need to know about these power dynamics, thinking about these niches and working against all of the forces that want to see them fail?
One distinction I make is that there's prefigurative power. So this is the capacity to create new things. If power is about the way that resources are distributed, then developing new resources, by definition, changes the existing power relations. So by developing something new, you create a certain independence from existing power relations. And by that fact, you are changing the existing power field. But then it doesn't stop there, because it's not enough. You also need countervailing power, so to challenge existing power structures. And this is often the focus of a lot of protest movements, is to kind of point out what's wrong, dismantle things, challenge them. So this is equally important. And then there's a third kind, at least, and there's many more, but which I would call reinforcive power. People refer to it as structural power, institutional power, but that suggests that it's the structures or the institutions that are exercising power, which is part of the story. But we need to kind of remember that there are still human beings who are developing all sorts of physical and organizational structures. And through that, we exercise reinforcive power. So we establish laws and regulations and norms and values. And ironically, that is also necessary for transformative power, because something is only transformative when it sticks. So if you create something new, it appears, but it doesn't, it's not stable, it's not taken up, it doesn't persist, then the transformative impact does not occur. So my argument is that transformative power really requires all three types of power. It's not about finding the one actor that exercises all these kinds of power, because an actor that has a lot of prefigurative power is probably not the same actor that has a lot of reinforcive power. Mm-hmm. And they might even contradict each other, because it comes with different kind of skills and verbs and backgrounds. So it's really, and yeah, then you end with the cliche, oh, we all need to collaborate. But it's not just collaboration, right? It's maybe also antagonism. So you need the countervailing powers to challenge the reinforcive powers, and so on.
Your answer brings to mind for me how in popular culture and media narratives, we see people so stricken with specific individuals, self-appointed hero types like Elon Musk, people that we need to wait for them to have the brainstorms and good ideas necessary to solve all of our problems. And this also links to me to a question that I want to ask you about technology. Because in our modern world, I think there's a close link between how we think of heroes and how we think of technology. That, you know, we overestimate the importance of new technologies just as much as we overestimate the importance of individual heroes. I'm curious to hear what you think the role of technology is in change. Because many technologies, I think, while they look or seem fancy, just serve to reinforce the status quo. I see this, again, a lot in the food world, with people touting everything from, you know, lab-based proteins or vertical agriculture that really, in my estimation, are just continuations of business as usual. Flor, what do you see as the role of technology in transformative change?
There are at least two things that I would like to say to that question. One is that technological innovation is necessary, but not enough to deal with a lot of the challenges. So I would never downplay its importance, but I would really challenge this idea that it will solve the problems. And that's why I've increasingly focused on this idea of social innovation, which is about how social relations change and the kind of the new practices, the new ideas, and the new forms of organization, new business models. All these things that are not technology, but that are necessary to not just enable the technological innovation, but to enable the whole societal change that we're talking about. But I would not end there, because I would argue a lot of social innovation is also not enough and has the same challenges, right? So you can have a great new business model or a community energy model, but that can also cause new problems. So to give an example, if you look at the example of the platform economy like Uber and Airbnb, which was, of course, enabled by certain technological innovations, but then it also came with all sorts of social innovations around sharing and all sorts of new business models. And at first instance, we all remember the excitement around the sharing economy and, oh my God, everybody can rent their house and everybody can become a taxi driver and we're going to disrupt the power of hotel chains and companies. And then when you look closer, you actually see that it's almost the opposite, or there's this other thing happening that it seems at first instance that there is a decentralization of power through the platform. But when you look at closer, you see that there is actually a re-centralization. So power gets decentralized, but then it gets re-centralized in this platform company that's behind it. And that really kind of takes out the economic flows from local, from cities all around the world to a Silicon Valley-based company.
That's a really interesting example, Flor, and it reminds me also of a parallel in food systems. Earlier I mentioned these alternative food networks, alternative seafood networks, where people are getting food at community pickups, community supported agriculture, direct delivery. And once that started picking up, you also, again, it went from decentralized to large corporations realizing that there was a market there and trying to infiltrate and take that space over for themselves.
And I think this is a very powerful metaphor that we need to keep reminding people of. And then especially with technology, we have all seen how some of the greatest technological innovations can be captured to reproduce existing inequalities.
Earlier, you mentioned this question of whether new ideas stick. And I want to return to this because I think it's important. You know, your point is well taken. You can have really creative ideas, but there's still a lot left on the playing field as to whether or not they'll be transformative. Do you have perhaps a favorite example of what it looks like when something sticks?
Well, maybe one step back. One thing that made me really cynical as I was studying social innovations and we were working on the Manifesto for Social Innovation, and I really believe in these translocal movements that are working on social innovation, but seeing how the sharing economy was being captured by the platform economy, and especially about how digital innovation was being captured and kind of almost exacerbating and accelerating hypercapitalism, that made me for a while quite cynical. And really kind of, not defeatist is a big word, but I was really taken back by that. And then the one thing that gives me hope is Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. So I really like the example of Wikipedia. And of course, there's also a lot of other, but those are more small examples. That there's cooperatives everywhere. The one interesting thing about Wikipedia is that it's so huge. Nobody can deny that Wikipedia is a huge success and that it has scaled at a global level. Like whenever you come with the examples of cooperatives and eco-villages, which I'm a huge fan of, but it's really difficult to make them say this is the example, because I don't think everybody should live in an eco-village. And I'm not even sure whether all our energy can be produced through local cooperatives. I would hope so. But we do have a proof that it is possible to do something at a massive global level. And so far, it hasn't been captured yet by pure for-profit commercial interests. So it is possible, this kind of crowdsourcing of knowledge. So yeah, that's what gives me hope, and what also excites me, these developments around platform cooperativism, and generally speaking, the cooperative movement.
The Wikipedia example is a great one. It's not one that I expected, but it really is. It's a good example of something different and something that it's undeniable that it's been a great success globally. Now, of course, as with anything, it has its challenges, but it also has this ever ongoing internal dynamic of people who are collaborating to work on those challenges. Thanks for that really great example, Floor. A word on Wikipedia for those who may not have thought about just how remarkable it really is. Wikipedia was founded in 2001. And 21 years later, it has roughly 6.5 million English language articles. There are, all told, 327 different language editions of Wikipedia, and the English articles represent only 11% of the 58 million articles across all of its languages. Wikipedia's community of editors has held steady, ranging since 2006 between 5,000 and 7,000 editors per year that have at least 100 article edits. Its editors and contributors have also collaboratively developed a robust, anarchical system of democratic governance and conflict resolution. Wikipedia is proof positive that alternative, distributed forms of social innovation are possible. And it illustrates perfectly, I think, the necessary interplay that Floor is speaking of between social and technological change. Back to the interview. You know, you mentioned earlier social innovation, and I don't want to miss a chance to talk about the Manifesto for Transformative Social Innovation. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, so the Manifesto for Transformative Social Innovation, it was written by, I think, 50 people in the end. And it was one of the outcomes of a research project that we had for 4 years between 2014 and 2017. And in this research project, we studied 20 movements that were working on social innovation. And so these are movements or networks that are working on social change, but rather than focusing on protest, they really focus on this prefiguration of alternatives, most of them. Some of them also do protest. So an example would be the Ecovillage movement. Another example would be Basic Income, the Earth Network. Another example is Hackerspaces. So we were studying that throughout these 4 years, and we wanted to organize a final event. And then that's when we had this idea of the assembly, the grassroots assembly or something, like bringing these representatives of the movements together. There were actually a lot of differences, and a lot of these movements also didn't know each other, and let alone collaborate. So we wanted to bring them together. That was in itself. And then also this manifesto was really an attempt to challenge them to formulate some principles. So we formulated 13 principles of transformative social innovation, building on, of course, our research and the concepts, but also really involving them. And we had discussions about what are important insights from their work. And then these 13 principles also were translated in an invitation for different kind of actors to commit, not just policymakers, but also intellectuals, activists, entrepreneurs, and citizens in general. We invited them to make some commitments to transformative social innovation. So those are also in the manifesto.
It really is an engaging document. What I really like about it is it's not an academic report. It's very accessible. It's a living document. I can tell that it's written to be something that is revised and reworked, much like Wikipedia. In fact, it's a work in progress. Floor, this has been really a fantastic conversation. I want to end with a question that I ask everybody. What is a radical change that you would like to see unfold in your lifetime? And how close are we?
Yeah, I really like this question. I've been thinking about it a bit. And there's one very abstract answer, which is the heterotopian society, inspired by Foucault's idea of heterotopia, where we accept diversity and difference, so really move away from this idea of what is the new system, but rather really try to see how can have a diversity of systems. But that's very abstract, so I try to also really think of something a bit more concrete, and it's radical in the sense that I think it would take a lot of effort, and I'm not sure whether it could work, but I think it could work. So it's radical, but I also think doable. And an image that I have is of workers around the world reclaiming the platform economy. So I always have this idea whenever I travel and I find myself in finding it really difficult to find an alternative for Uber and Airbnb. I try to avoid it, but once in a while, you know, like you're literally in the place where Uber is literally the only option. That's the first time I took one. I was somewhere in a rural area. There was simply no other option. And what I started to do is to interview the Uber drivers about what they thought about Uber. Because I thought, you know, I read all this critique of it, but what do these drivers themselves think? And I was really intrigued about how frustrated many of them are actually with, you know, the percentage that the company takes. And I was imagining, what if everybody that would ever take an Uber driver, ever take an Uber or ever goes to an Airbnb, what if we would organize and find a way to have a kind of a cooperative alternative? But the problem is that a lot of these initiatives are local. And that's what makes it so difficult to make the step, right? Because you don't want to have 100 different apps for each different city. You don't want to have a different app. So I've been fantasizing about a Wikipedia-like a cooperative structure where you can unionize the people who are in this platform, that are working in these platforms, but kind of try to kind of get them involved in this kind of cooperative form of doing the platform economy. So this is something that I think could be really radical, but what we need are really, really smart programmers that would be willing to work for a non-profit rate, right? So but this is something I often fantasize about.
I think that's a really fantastic idea, and it brings us full circle to the idea that we need both social innovation and technological innovation. Flora, thank you very much. It's been really lovely, and it's great to reconnect with you too.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. In this episode of The Second Transition, I spoke with Flora Avellino from the Dutch Research Institute for Transitions. This episode of The Second Transition was produced on the treaty lands and traditional territories of the Mississauga of the Credit, also known as Dish with One Spoon Territory. The Second Transition podcast is supported in part by the Errol Food Institute and in part by VoiceEd Radio. See you next time.